Tsongkhapa says that that this bodhicitta is a quality which is like a treasure, that treasure house that collects all the positive qualities, and it's like an elixir that transforms the ordinary metals into gold, as I have been explaining during the last few days, that once you develop such a bodhicitta, this altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, it immediately brings peace, relaxation and tranquility in your mind. And out of all types of benevolent mind, mind wishing to help other sentient beings, the supreme, the one that is like the king, is the bodhicitta. It's not only a best mind wishing to help all other sentient beings, but it is one that is supported and assisted by wisdom. It is because of the presence of this bodhicitta that we, a practitioner, do not hesitate or do not get tired in cultivating the multifarious aspects of the virtuous practices when he or she is on the way of her spiritual path, spiritual practice to achieve enlightenment. It is because of this, Tsongkhapa says, that this is really, this bodhicitta is really the foundation which, on which all the positive practices and qualities are based. It is the motivating factor by which we are able to engage in developing all virtuous practices. And in terms of collecting the two collections, merit and wisdom, this bodhicitta is like an elixir that transforms the ordinary metals into gold, whether it is in terms of achieving the highest happiness in the form of omniscience, or in terms of experiencing even a minor peace and happiness in your day-to-day life. It's all related to developing such a mind. Once you have developed such a mind, wishing to benefit all sentient beings, then it is but natural that you will continue to experience all these different dimensions of peace and happiness. And once you develop such a bodhicitta, you develop this courage and determination to achieve omniscience, no matter, even if it takes many countless eons, no matter you have to work for the benefit of each and every individual sentient beings. So it is from that point of view that it is this bodhicitta which is the most powerful mind, most powerful beneficial mind. It is because of the presence of such a bodhicitta that you are gradually able to ultimate this state in the form of wisdom truth body and the form body. Even for actualizing the wisdom truth body, it is not enough that you have developed realization of emptiness, but it must be supported by such a bodhicitta. And as I said, this is really like a treasure house, a treasure where there is the presence of a collection of infinite virtuous collections, positive practices. Knowing thus, this great bodhisattvas had taken this practice of development of bodhicitta as the heart practice, as the most important practice, and therefore from a mind that is not biased. Now in the case of the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas, they have achieved such higher realizations as a result of their having thoroughly analyzed the way things are, analyzed the truth, the reality. So therefore the bodhisattvas who follow the footsteps of Buddha, they also develop the most profound part, the quickest part in the form of bodhicitta. And sometimes my Western friends ask me this question, that what is the best and the quickest and the path to achieve enlightenment. So if you are really someone who is looking for the best, the profound and the quickest path, then it is the bodhicitta. Meditate on bodhicitta. There is no other way. So knowing thus, the brave bodhisattvas undertook the development of this bodhicitta as the most important practice. And this bodhisattvas possess infinite courage and possess great skill. And I feel that these bodhisattvas, they really are the one who have adopted the best method to fulfill their own purposes. Of course, their method of fulfilling their own purposes is not through egoistic means and methods, but by engaging in skilled methods of helping others, their own purpose is fulfilled as a byproduct. Now, in the case of the Sarvakas and Pratika Buddhas, they wholeheartedly work for achieving liberation and peace for themselves and did not develop bodhicitta, and therefore they ended up achieving only liberation just for themselves. And therefore I tell people that if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish. Be wisely selfish in the sense that the more you help other sentient beings, the more you maintain far-sightedness, the more you will gather more friends. And as a result, when you experience difficulty, naturally all friends will flock around you and will be ready to help you. On the other hand, when you are healthy, if you forget and neglect everybody and disregard others' needs and so forth, then you will become one who will be backbited and to whom everybody wants to distance, and you will be left alone with no friend. When you look on the right side, you find this person might do something to me because I didn't do very well to this person. And then when you look towards your left, then again you see also here we had some misunderstanding, so I can't trust this person also. And if you look in front or back, you find similar kind of people who are not so friendly to you because of your attitude. On the other hand, if you develop such an altruistic wish, then all purposes, those of oneself and others, will be fulfilled. Knowing thus, the brave bodhisattvas have taken this precious mind of bodhicitta as the heart practice, as the most important practice, and therefore we should develop such a bodhicitta which we have not developed, and further enhance and strengthen such a bodhicitta if one has already cultivated. And other practices like imagining yourself as a deity and engaging in the so-called profound tantric practices, tantric ritual practices, all these should be taken as the branch practices. And once you are able to do that, once you are able to take this development of bodhicitta as the most important and hard practice, then your practice will become a Buddhist practice, and your practice will become a Mahayana practice. And in, as I said earlier, in Tibet, tantric flourished, and the tantric practice flourished and disseminated like anything. And the tantric practice, which was practiced so secretly in India, that became almost like a public practice, a public teaching. So if you want to engage in such a profound, genuine tantric practice, then the most important thing is to meditate on bodhicitta. And some of the scholars really mentioned that some of the Tibetan way of tantric practice is a kind of corrupted practice, because you do not know how to practice them and you make it public. So the secret practice, a practice that must be practiced in a hidden way, was made kind of public and well known in Tibet. However, if you undertake such practices with the presence or practice of bodhicitta, then your tantric practice will also become a genuine, useful practice. On the other hand, if you try to overreach tantric practice without having an inkling of idea about the bodhicitta and so forth, then it is really difficult to achieve any result. No matter how many initiations you receive from a teacher, no matter how many tantric commentaries you receive from your teacher. So, instead, if you talk more about bodhicitta and some of the sutra practices, this will also help the people within the help the wider community, the wider society. On the other hand, if you simply give some initiations as if you have some special blessings to give, and then in that when you, if you also receive those offerings in the name of giving tantric, high tantric initiation and so forth, then I don't think there will be much benefit. And I will once again tell you this story of someone visiting an attendant of an abbot. And when he reached that house, the abbot was not there in the house. Then he asked the attendant, "Where is your abbot?" Then he said, "My abbot went to frighten the elderly men and women, all men and women." So in one sense, this is an instruction. Because sometimes without giving the main teaching, if you simply frighten people by saying, "If you do this, you will go to hell. If you don't obey to the Lama's word and teaching, you will go to hell. And therefore, in order to save yourself, you make this offering, bring this object, bring that article." If you engage in such practices, then this will definitely become a cause of oneself falling into hell. So on the other hand, if you talk about bodhicitta, try to practice bodhicitta, and talk about this essential practices of the sutra, this will help everybody. And in your case also, if you undertake these practices, it is definite that you will have a better rebirth. And also at the time of your death, you will be able to die peacefully because of your having lived a good life, a beneficial life. Therefore, all of us should make special effort in developing a compassionate mind, warm-hearted, to become a warm-hearted person, and that I would say is the essence of Dharma teaching. So as I said earlier, today we will perform a short ritual of ceremony of developing the aspirational bodhicitta, and during the last few days we have been talking about the need to develop a compassionate mind supported by wisdom, realizing emptiness, and thereby how to achieve omniscience. So here once again you should reflect carefully about this, the importance of this bodhicitta, and then with that kind of motivation, if you develop this aspirational bodhicitta in a more ceremonial way, this will help you stabilize your mind, and it will help you leave a positive imprint for the development of this bodhicitta, so that before long you will be able to cultivate genuine bodhicitta, genuine altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings within yourself. And here, in order to cultivate such an aspirational bodhicitta, first of all you should imagine the presence of actual Buddha and endow it with all the major and minor special qualities, and around him imagine also the presence of Manjushri, Maitreya, deities, bodhisattvas in the form of celestial beings, and similarly Tara and so forth, who are also female celestial beings, and similarly imagine the great masters like Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, Chandraketi, Buddha Palita, Baba Viveka, Matangiva, Shakyashinin, Nagabodhi, Chandrakirti, Shandideva, and so on. Imagine all these masters in the form of human beings who hold the profound and the vast lineage of the stages of the path, and similarly Asanga and Vasubandhu, the two brothers, and then Sangasena, and the masters of the extensive practice, and then Dignag, the great logician, the great master of Buddhist epistemology, and similarly Dharmakirti and so forth. And since we have some Chinese brothers and sisters here, and in your case, Buddhism came to China before it came to Tibet. So in your lineage also, you should imagine many of these great Chinese masters who uplifted and upheld and preserved and transmitted the teaching of the Buddha, and also imagine the great Tibetan masters, Guru Pema Sambhava, and the 25 close disciples, the masters of the ancient transmission, Nyingma transmission, and the masters of Sajja tradition, and similarly the masters of Kagyu and Gelug tradition. And we have here also a number of Mongolians. In your case, you should also imagine those great Mongolian masters, the great learned practitioners. And we also have, so I think here we have some Koreans, and also maybe some Vietnamese, and also some Japanese. And in your case, your tradition is primarily rooted in the Chinese tradition. So in your case also, imagine all those lineage masters, and then those who came from the West. You don't have such an old Buddhist tradition, so I have nothing to say. So in the beginning of the 20th century, you have started taking interest in the Buddha's teaching. So imagine all the root and lineage lamas. And the lama is just a messenger to pass the word that comes from the Buddha. So imagine all these objects of refuge actually present before you. And as I told you, this story of Taglung Shabdung getting an actual vision of all the Taglung lineage lamas. So similarly, in our case, because of our thick obscuration of afflict promotions, we don't see any of these lineage lamas. So irrespective of whether you are able to see them vividly or not, they are always looking at us. These bodhisattvas and buddhas, they have their thought with us all the time. So imagine that they are all present here, and in front of them we develop this aspirational bodhicitta. And the purpose of developing such aspirational bodhicitta is not just for your personal peace and happiness. It should be developed to help all sentient beings achieve Buddhahood and enlightenment. And it is for the sake of all these sentient beings, thinking that I will help them, I will assist them, I will benefit them. With that kind of mind, you should develop the aspirational bodhicitta. Unfortunately, until now, our main focus is development of afflict emotions. Our main deed is implementing and expressing these afflictive emotions. And all these negative emotions and the expressions of these negative emotions came primarily through this total concentration and focus just upon one's own happiness and well-being. Now it is time to realize that such a narrow-minded way of thinking about one's own personal happiness is a wrong attitude, a wrong outlook. And the correct and unmistaken attitude and outlook is to think more about the happiness of other sentient beings And it's for that purpose that you are going to cultivate this aspirational bodhicitta here. So first you make this supplication, requesting the Lama to grant this bodhicitta. Master, listen to me. Just as in the past, the Buddhas, Arhats, and the perfectly enlightened beings, and the great bodhisattvas who are on the higher spiritual paths, have first cultivated this unsurpassing supreme mind to enlightenment. Similarly, use your name. I with such and such name, kind master, help me to cultivate this mind to the unsurpassing supreme enlightenment. So one repetition is enough. What is really important is that you should wholeheartedly develop this genuine appreciation and aspiration towards bodhicitta, and you have wholeheartedly made this request to the Lama to help you cultivate this aspirational bodhicitta. Now, in order to cultivate this aspirational bodhicitta, you must purify negative deeds and accumulate merit, and this is done by reflecting on the seven branch practices. It can be done either by reciting the lines from Shantidevas or by reflecting on the lines from Aryabhadra. So we should develop a clear understanding of these seven branches. So we will recite it here. Imagine the presence of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all the supreme masters in front of you, and then you should reflect carefully on the five branches, which are paying homage, making offerings, confessing your negative deeds, rejoicing at the virtuous deeds done by others, and then requesting the Buddhas to turn the wheel of the teaching, and requesting them not to pass away, and dedicating all the virtues done by yourself and others to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. In accordance with one method of cultivating the aspirational bodhicitta, in accordance with Pungdar Rinpoche, is to reciting the confessional prayer. So I hope it is not inconvenient to you. And while doing so, you should confess all the wrongdoings, all the negative deeds that you have done physically, verbally and mentally. And all these wrongdoings primarily emanate from your self-cherishing attitude. And even though you may not have intentionally cultivated such a self-cherishing attitude, but because of this self-cherishing attitude, you end up here and there committing wrongdoings, committing negative deeds, and of harming other sentient beings. So until now we have very faithfully allowed ourselves being controlled by this self-cherishing attitude. Now we should see the faults of this self-cherishing attitude and see it as a poison that is the source of death and destruction. And you should clearly now develop the recognition what kind of wrong things that you have done because of self-cherishing attitude. And now you should develop this wish not to engage in such wrongdoings. So if it is not inconvenient, and stand up and start doing prostrations while reciting that confessional prayer. Next is taking refuge, about which we discussed yesterday and even day before yesterday. So while taking refuge, when you think about the Buddha, it's important not only to think about the historical Buddha, but also the four bodies of the Buddha. And when we think about Dharma, then the Dharma of the Savakas and Patika Buddhas are preliminary Dharmas. And here when we talk about taking refuge to Dharma, we are taking refuge to the complete, unmistaken Mahayana path, which possesses unique feature of vastness and profundity. So therefore we are talking about a path which is essentially focused on development of bodhicitta, influenced by the view of emptiness, a path that leads to achievement of omniscience. So imagine that you are taking refuge to Dharma, and in short you are taking refuge to the Mahayana Dharma in the sense of true cessation and true path. And in order to so this Mahayana path, which is complete and unmistaken, which leads to the achievement of omniscience, and the one, the Sangha, or the spiritual community who undertakes the practice of such a path is not the Savakas and Patika Buddhas, but it is the Mahayana superior beings, the excelled beings, which are known as the Aryas, who have developed direct insight into the meaning of emptiness. So it is these sublime beings who have developed the rare Mahayana Dharma within their mind, who are the objects of refuge, who are known as Sangha here. So in this sense that you are taking refuge to the omniscient Buddha and the complete unmistaken path in the form of true path and true cessation, leading to the achievement of such omniscience, and the sublime beings, sublime practitioners who have developed this spiritual path within themselves, these three are the objects of refuge. And you take refuge to these three, again not for your personal welfare and well-being, but to help all sentient beings achieve the state of enlightenment. In short, you should develop compassion, aspiring how nice if all these sentient beings are without suffering and the process of suffering, and with wish, thinking how nice if all these sentient beings achieve the complete state of enlightenment. And this can be done by clearly developing cognizance of oneself and others, that we are all under the subjugation and domination of actions and afflictive emotions. And it is in this context that it is the omniscient Buddha who can help us get liberated from such a cycle existence. So it is in this way that you take refuge. And also in terms of time period, you are not taking refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha just for this life, only for this life, or until you achieve just Nirvana and liberation, but you take refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for the time period or until you achieve omniscience. So clearly developing recognition of this important process and features of taking refuge, and with this strong urgent wish to help all sentient beings achieve omniscience, you should think that I am seeking the support and making this request to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and repeat this: Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the ten directions, please pay attention to me. Master, please pay attention to me. I with such and such name, use your name. From today until I achieve the essence of omniscience, I take refuge to the Buddha, the supreme of the biped. Master, listen to me. I with such and such name, from today until I achieve the essence of omniscience, I take refuge to the supreme Dharma, the state of being free from attachment. Master, listen to me. I with such and such time, from today until I achieve the essence of enlightenment, I take refuge to the supreme of the Sangha community, those who have attained the sublime path. And when you do the second repetition, this completes taking refuge. And next is again accumulating merit. Again, we will recite the prayer of seven limb practice. Again, imagine the presence of all the objects of refuge, and in front of them, in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, I will promise and make a commitment to practice the path. And having made the promise and the commitment, in order to generate genuine bodhicitta, I must make my mind fertile and suitable. And what obstructs developing such a mind is the negative afflictive emotions. So these negative afflictive emotions must be removed, and the facilitating factor is the positive qualities, the collection of merit. So therefore, when you recite this prayer of the seven limb practice, we should clearly recognize the faults and the mistakes that have committed. And even the wish to achieve liberation just for oneself is a mistake from the point of view of achieving omniscience for the sake of all sentient beings, even though it is not a mistake from the point of view of the Sarvakas and Patika Buddhas. So with that understanding, even if you develop this wish to achieve omniscience for the sake of all sentient beings, this itself will help you purify many of these negative emotions. However, as a facilitating factor, again you should reflect on the seven limb practice to collect merit and purify negative deeds. And in this way, having made your mind suitable and fertile, then you engage in the actual cultivation of bodhicitta. This completes accumulating merit. Next is training the mind. We have been during the last many days discussing about how to train in the mind. So in short, as is said in the Guru Puja, that all these suffering sentient beings are my mother. It is only through the change of life that we are unable to recognize them as your mother. So not only they have acted as your mother, but even when you have remained as a, even when they have remained as a neutral being, they have all been kind to you. And it is these sentient beings towards which we have to relate to, from which we derive the benefit. And as he said in the mind training text, that you should simply remember the kindness of all of these mother sentient beings. And in the case of these mother sentient beings, they are similar like yourself, wanting maximum happiness and not wanting even the tiniest and the smallest suffering. And in the case of experiencing happiness, however much happiness we get, we do not get satisfied. So in this case, we are all same. However, if you compare yourself with others, then you will find that however important you may be, but you are just one single individual. Whereas in the case of the rest of the sentient beings, their numbers are infinite and countless. So if you ask anybody who has some sense and who has some kind of wisdom, if you ask them, who is more important, you or the rest of the sentient beings? Definitely everyone will say the rest of the sentient beings are more important. And also it is a fact that not only they are special in terms of their number, but it's also the fact that that it's not the case that you are not related to them. As I said, they have been very kind to you, and that you are very much dependent and related to them. Now, as far as this question of self-cherishing attitude, it is only a deceptive mind, and it is really not possible to gain genuine long-lasting happiness by developing this self-cherishing attitude. And just like it is important to recognize poison as poison, and by finding its destructive, harmful effect, you do not intake poison. So similarly, by realizing this self-cherishing attitude as an aconite, as a poison, we should try to discourage this. And on the other hand, if you develop this mind that cherishes the well-being of the sentient beings, and when you wholeheartedly devote your body, mind and speech in serving other sentient beings, not only you will fulfill your temporary purposes, but all your long-term purposes will be fulfilled. And as I mentioned earlier, that there are different types of happiness that you experience while remaining within the cycle existence. The possibilities of developing spiritual qualities when you are cultivating these various levels of spiritual path, and finally you are being able to achieve the highest state of peace in the form of omniscience is possible due to this bodhicitta. And in this way you will be able to see that this mind of bodhicitta that cherishes the well-being of all of the sentient beings is really the source of all happiness, all peace. And then it is followed by the next verse by saying that in short, you should be able to see the drawbacks of your self-cherishing attitude and the great qualities of the Buddha. Now, if you compare yourself with the Buddha, you will find that Buddha even today is such a great source of peace, happiness and inspiration to millions of people, millions of sentient beings. Whereas in our case, we still suffer, we are still entrapped within confusion. So when you compare and see who has more qualities, you or the Buddha, who has more compassion, you or the Buddha, then you will find there is no comparison at all, and you are a kind of embodiment of these negative emotions, primarily because of you have wholeheartedly practiced the self-cherishing attitude for many lives to come. Whereas in the case of Buddha, he is an embodiment of compassion and omniscience because of having primarily developed bodhicitta. And realizing and seeing this fact, you should develop a mind that aspires to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings wholeheartedly. And as is said also in Bodhicaryavatara, that we always profess and claim that I am someone who takes refuge to Buddha, to the Buddha, to the Dharma and to the Sangha. If this is the case, then your main practice is to aspire to cultivate this bodhicitta that leads to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. In the case of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they see sentient beings as their only beloved child. Now, this being the case, how is it possible, how is it proper for you to see these sentient beings who are seen as their beloved child by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? How it is proper if you disregard them and ignore the welfare of these sentient beings? Indirectly, this means you have also no genuine respect and regard to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This is like how you act in relation to your friends. If you regard someone as your very close friend, then naturally you will also regard his wishes or her wishes and the things he or she wants to do. You will also help that person in fulfilling their wishes and give consideration to their needs. So this being the case, it is extremely important to pay regard and respect to Buddha's and Bodhisattva's wish and thereby help sentient beings. So therefore, the more you respect and veneration to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the more you should be able to recognize the kindness of these sentient beings. It is in relation to these sentient beings you accumulate merit. It is in relation to these sentient beings you achieve omniscience. It is in relation to these sentient beings that you achieve happiness, even when you are within the cycle existence. It is in relation to these sentient beings that you earn name and fame. It is in relation to these sentient beings that you collect wealth and become rich. So in this way, wholeheartedly develop a clear recognition of the kindness of the ascendant beings, and then you can also reflect on the verses which relates that self-cherishing attitude is the door to all downfalls, and regarding others as important is the door to all peace and happiness. And therefore I will engage in the yoga and the practice of exchanging myself to others. With such an understanding, develop the mind. Sit in a kneeling position. And if you have problem in the legs, don't exert yourself. There's no need to force yourself. Imagine that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present in front of you as a witness that you are cultivating this bodhicitta today. And just as Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have cultivated bodhicitta, similarly I will cultivate such a mind of bodhicitta and liberate the sentient beings who are not liberated, free those who are not free, console those who are not consoled, and so on. So to liberate, meaning those who are not liberated from suffering, I will liberate them. Who are not free from the bondage of true origin of suffering, I will free them. I will console those who are not consoled, means that I will who are not consoled because of being overpowered by self-grasping, I will help them get consoled by showing the true path. And I will help those who have not transcended suffering, I will help them to transcend suffering, to completely transcend suffering. So that means to actualize, help them actualize the state of true cessation, which is a state of peace, state of perfection, state of excellence. So in short, I will help all these sentient beings achieve omniscience with that kind of intense aspiration, supplication and request. Repeat this: Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the ten directions, please listen to me. Master, please listen to me. I with such and such name in this life and in other lives must have engaged in virtuous practices like giving, morality, meditation and so forth. And similarly, I have instigated others to do so by rejoicing their virtuous practices and so forth. And I will offer these virtuous practices to cultivate bodhicitta as it has been cultivated by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, just as they have cultivated bodhicitta. I will cultivate them. I with such and such name from today until I achieve the essence of Buddhahood, I will cultivate this mind that leads to unsurpassing supreme enlightenment, to liberate sentient beings who are not liberated, free who are not free, console who are not consoled, and completely transcend suffering who have not transcended suffering. When you do the second repetition, develop a clear recognition that you have obtained this precious human life, met with the teaching of the Buddha, particularly the Mahayana teaching, and how fortunate that at this point we are studying the great stages of the path to enlightenment by Tsongkhapa. How fortunate that we have this opportunity to meditate, reflect on precious texts like Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. And since I have access to this great texts which primarily focus on the development of bodhicitta, how fortunate it is that I am able to talk about bodhicitta, meditate on bodhicitta, and how fortunate that today I have obtained this human life. I am able to think, I am able to judge, I am able to discriminate just as the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have wholeheartedly practiced bodhicitta. So today I will also take bodhicitta as the heart of my practice and make my life meaningful. And during the third repetition, during the past many countless lives, probably I have never got an opportunity to develop such a bodhicitta. And today, fortunately, I have obtained this precious life and encountered this precious teaching. And primarily due to the compassion of the teaching, compassionate teaching of Buddha Shakyamuni, that I have access to this teaching. I'm able to hear this teaching, and I also have interest to this teaching and appreciation to this teaching, and therefore I'm able to, it's amazing that I've got this opportunity to cultivate bodhicitta in front of these great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Today I'm doing something that I've never done before, and this is the occasion on which I'm constructing the first foundation for my higher spiritual realizations and practices, and I will therefore regard this practice as something very special, very unique, very important. I'm doing something I have never done before. I'm cultivating something I've never cultivated before. In this way, develop great delight in your mind, thinking, this is my prayer for the longevity of life of Lama. This is my way of helping the cause of the Tibetan welfare. In this way, you can think about all the positive things that could be fulfilled by developing such a mind. And having cultivated this mind, you should think that I will cultivate this mind, and then you should think I will never allow this mind degenerate and lose. So therefore, this mind is called cultivating the aspirational bodhicitta with commitment. Also repeat these lines from Bodhicharyavatara. Today my life has become meaningful. I've obtained this precious human life. I am born as the lineage of the Buddha, and from today onwards, come whatever, I will not defile this Buddha's lineage. May the bodhicitta I have not cultivated be cultivated. May those that cultivated enhanced. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel their suffering. Next topic is maintaining the spirit of enlightenment. I am on page 69, if you have the English version. I'm on page 69. Maintaining and not weakening what you have attained. You need to know the precepts, so I will explain them. This has two parts. First is the training in the precepts that cause you not to weaken your spirit of enlightenment in this lifetime. And this has four parts. The first is the training in the precepts to recall the benefits of the spirit of enlightenment in order to increase the strength of your enthusiasm for it. Think about the benefits of the spirit of enlightenment after you have either researched them in the sutras or listened to them from your guru. They are explained in detail in the area of Stark Sutra, so look there. As stated above, this text says, the spirit of enlightenment is like the seed of all the Buddha's qualities, and it also states, the spirit of enlightenment is like a summary because it includes all the bodhisattva deeds and aspirational prayers. It is like a summary in that sense that everything is compiled into a brief indication, although there are endless detailed explanations of the parts. Like a summation of these parts, it is said to be a synopsis which brings together the key points of all the bodhisattva paths. The benefits mentioned in the bodhisattva levels are those of the aspirational state of enlightenment. That text states two benefits for the first stable generation of the spirit of enlightenment, becoming a pure field of accumulating merit and being fully endowed with protective merit. The first benefit, becoming a pure field for accumulating merit, is as follows. As engaging in the bodhisattva deeds states, and revert both in the worlds of humans and deities, you become an object of worship for all living beings immediately after you have developed the spirit of enlightenment. And when you read the advantages of such a mind, for example, as we have read in the Sutra Alamkara, it really makes a big impact on your mind and very strongly moves your mind. So it is important to keep such a text and occasionally read such precious text. In accordance with the statement that immediately His Holiness making fun of one Tibetan lady whose umbrella turned upside down. In accordance with the statement that immediately after developing the spirit of enlightenment, you surpass all the great arhats in terms of your lineage, you become superior and highest. Even when you perform a small meritorious action, it gives forth limitless effects, so you are a field for accumulating merit. As all the world relies on you, you are like the earth, thus you are like a father to all beings. The second benefit, being fully endowed with protective merit, is as follows. As you are always protected by guidance that are twice as numerous as those of a universal monarch, you cannot be harmed by yakshas or local spirits even when you are sleeping, drunk or careless. Secret mantras and knowledge mantras that can cure epidemics, injuries and infections but not effective in the hands of living beings become effective when someone with a stable generation of the spirit of enlightenment uses them. Why mention the mantras that do work when used by living beings? So Solana is saying that when you, so even in the case of those people who visit various homes in performing ritual prayers, there also it is important to do so with the mind of bodhicitta. The bodhisattva levels teaches that when your spirit of enlightenment is stable, you also easily accomplish the collections of actions, specifying and so forth. So if you have this, you also quickly accomplish ordinary spiritual attainments. And those people who go for ritual practices, of course you need to do whatever is requested to do, but in the beginning probably you can start your prayer by reflecting on, for example, by reading, for example, the 8th chapter from Bodhicharyavatara and develop some kind of feeling of bodhicitta, and then if you read the rest of the text that is being requested, so whatever words you recite before you start your prayer, if you reflect a little bit more on bodhicitta, and then it will be very useful. And the benefactors who have requested for the teaching, and they might think that this ritual prayer may be not so effective, particularly in the case of the beginning when you quietly recite some of these verses on bodhicitta. But when the actual prayer comes and then you play the drums, the cymbals and play all the musical instruments and make lot of noise, then the benefactors might think, oh, this seems to be effective. So this clearly shows the benefactors who make such a request also unfortunately has no idea what is the actual teaching is. And for example, look at Buddha himself. I think when he come for the teaching, when he also come for the teaching, for example, giving the Four Noble Truth, he would simply come as an ordinary monk and sit on the throne and give the teaching. He will be not invited by the play of the cymbals and musical instruments, the long horns and so forth, and which the Tibetan Lamas are so fond of, which I think is a silly thing which I myself engaged in the earlier days. But it's really important not to get confused with such practices. And one of the best practitioners of the prayers are the monks from Lower and Upper Tantra College. And it is well known in Tibet also. There is a well-known saying that please eat like the monks from Tantric colleges and also pray like the monks from the Tantric colleges. So these monks from Tantric colleges normally bring with them a huge bowl. So that's the meaning, that eat like them. And even in their case, there is no fun of your visiting homes bringing with you these big bowls and also reciting the prayer with your unique monastic tune. What's important is really when you do so, you should think on these important points of bodhicitta and so on. Whenever you are staying, there will arise no fear, no causes of fear, no famine and so forth. And you will quell those that have already happened. Also, after you will have little trouble, and you will be naturally healthy in your next life. Even if some harm does arise, it will not last long or be severe. When you engage in the welfare of living beings, giving teachings, etc., your body will not feel tired. You will not be forgetful, nor will your mind degenerate. If you are one who abides in the Bodhisattva lineage, you naturally have few dysfunctional tendencies. Once you have developed the spirit of enlightenment, the dysfunctional tendencies of your mind and body are extremely slight. You are patient and gentle, so that if someone harms you, you bear it and do not harm in return. If you see others hurting each other, you are very displeased. You seldom give rise to anger, jealousy, deceitfulness, concealment and the like. If these do arise, they are not intense, do not last long and quickly disappear. It's difficult for you to be reborn in miserable realms. Even if you are reborn there, you will quickly get free. Even while there, your suffering will be slight, and because of it, you will be very disenchanted with cyclical existence and generate compassion for the beings there. If the merit of the spirit of enlightenment were to take form, it would not even fit into the sky, nor does the merit of making material offerings to the Buddha equal even a mere portion of it, as is said in the questions of the householder, Viradhata Sutra. While the great Atisha was circumambulating the Vajra seat in Bodhi Gaya, he thought, "How can I obtain full enlightenment quickly?" Thereupon he had a vision wherein the smaller statue stood up and asked the larger statues, "What should those who wish to quickly attain Buddhahood train in?" The larger ones replied, "They should train in the spirit of enlightenment." Also in the sky above the main temple, a young woman asked this question to an older woman, and Atisha heard the same answer as before. Therefore it is said he became more certain about the spirit of enlightenment. Accordingly understand that the spirit of enlightenment comprises the key points of all the Mahayana personal instructions, is a great treasure of all the spiritual attainment, is the feature that distinguishes the Mahayana from the Hinayana, and is the excellent basis that spurs you to undertake the great effective bodhisattva deeds, becoming even more fervent about cultivating it. Act like a thirsty person hearing talk of water, for when the conquerors and their children used their marvelous wisdom to examine the past to great details for many eons, they saw just this to be the excellent method of becoming a Buddha, as is said in the Bodhisattva Acharya. So these are the countless merits of bodhicitta. So when you are well, meditate on bodhicitta. When you are ill, meditate on bodhicitta. When you are dying, meditate on bodhicitta. When you are in the intermediate state, meditate on bodhicitta. When you have fear, meditate on bodhicitta. When you have anxiety and worry, meditate on bodhicitta. So this is really like a panacea that cures all sickness, all illness. And there is no better practice of transference of consciousness than meditating on bodhicitta. And if you meditate on bodhicitta when you are relaxed and have a happy mood, you should meditate on bodhicitta. This will help you not become arrogant. And when you suffer from illness, suffer from old age, when others look down upon you, meditate on bodhicitta. You will not get discouraged. You will develop genuine conviction within your mind. So this mind of bodhicitta is really like the panacea that cures all illness. This is the best way to prolong your own life. This is the best way, I think, to increase your wisdom, sharpen your wisdom, as is said in one of the texts by Nyingma Tulku. And he says, if you are someone who wants to increase the wisdom, then study the spiritual text, study the 10-8 systems. And he clearly says that if you compare two practices for developing your wisdom, for one month you should recite the mantra of Manjushri to increase your wisdom, and then another month you study the collective topics, the logic on the mind and so forth. Then he says, if you compare the results of these 2 months of various practices for cultivating wisdom, he says, it is not so sure whether your mind will become more sharp after reciting 1 month mantra of Manjushri. But if you engage in study of this logic and collective topics for 1 month, there is no doubt about your being able to increase your wisdom. And also I would say, if you meditate on bodhicitta, this will definitely purify your negative deeds, rather than completing 100,000 recitations of the 100 syllable mantra. And I once tried to complete it and couldn't complete it, and my senior tutor Ling Rinpoche, it seems also he started and couldn't complete it. So this kind of recitation of 100 syllable mantra is of course a wonderful example for purifying your negative deeds, but I would say it would be even more effective if you reflect and meditate on bodhicitta and develop and practice it. So in this way, if you reflect on the many advantages of bodhicitta, this will develop enthusiasm and appreciation. And once you develop the mind that this is the most important practice, this will help you lead your life in accordance with it. Next is the training in the precepts to generate the spirit of enlightenment 6 times each day in order to increase the actual spirit of enlightenment. This has 2 parts. First is not giving up your development of the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. You have taken as your witness the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and teachers, and in their presence committed yourself to liberate all beings who are not liberated and so forth. If you then see that living beings are so numerous and their behavior is mean, or that the time wherein you must strive for many eons is long, or that you must train in the 2 collections that are limitless and difficult to do, and you take this as a reason to become discouraged and to abandon your responsibility to develop the spirit of enlightenment, it is a sin greater than a cardinal transgression of the vows of individual liberation. As he said in the world summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 line states. Thus it says that such a bodhisattva's ethical discipline is faulty. Restraint from sarvaka and pratyeka Buddha considerations is the bodhisattva's highest ethical discipline. So were bodhisattvas to weaken this restraint, they would destroy their ethical discipline. You can clearly see these 2 differences, because in the case of bodhisattva vow, you have cultivated such a bodhicitta in front of the Buddhas and bodhisattvas to help achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. So if you break such a vow, it is much more sinful. And if you give up such a mind and develop inferior mind, then your discipline is faulty. For if bodhisattvas do not cast aside such restraint, then even were they to indulge in sensory pleasures, they would not destroy the attitude of restraint that is unique to the bodhisattva. Again, the verse summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 line states. The bodhisattvas enjoy the 5 sensory objects if they take refuge in the Buddha, the teaching and the community of noble beings, and fix their minds on omniscience, thinking, I will attain Buddhahood. Understand that these adepts keep the perfection of ethical discipline. If they give up their promised intention, they must wander for a long time in miserable rebirths, as Shantideva says in the following verses. Think how very wonderful they have attained something like this and never give it up. Devoting particular attention to this, vow over and over not to give it up for even an instant. Next, second point is the training to increase the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. It's not enough merely not to give up the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. Increase it with great effort 3 times during the day and 3 times at night. If you can practice the aforementioned extensive rituals, do so. If not, visualize the field of accumulating merit, and after you make offerings, refine your love, compassion, and so forth. Then adopt the spirit of enlightenment 6 times, reciting the following ritual words 3 times on each occasion. So as soon as you get up in the morning, bless your speech, and then recite these words: I go for refuge and enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the community. By the merit of practicing the 6 perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help living beings. And so recite at least these 3 times a day, and then also in the midnight. Sometimes you wake up without any reason, and you sometimes get it difficult to go back to sleep. So why don't you recite such verses, such profound practices? So this verse, taking refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and cultivation of Bodhicitta, is really a very crucial practice, and it contains the essential points of teaching of the Buddha. I met one Lama from Kham, and who requested me, saying that please give me the teaching and explanation on this verse of taking refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and cultivation of Bodhicitta. And I was really very pleased. Then I told him that you really know the essence of the teaching. Next is the training in the precept not to mentally abandon the living beings for whose sake you develop the spirit of enlightenment. Although this precept is not found in the pertinent sections of the lamp for the path to enlightenment or ritual procedures for the spirit of enlightenment and Buddha Bodhisattva vows, in his commentary on the difficult points of the lamp for the path to enlightenment, Atisha says, by caring for and not abandoning living beings, you maintain the spirit of enlightenment for the sake of its objects, its benefits, the ritual for generating it, its general increase, and not forgetting it. It is listed in this context and does not contradict the intended meaning of the root text to so train in this also. The measure of mentally abandoning living beings is when you produce the thought, now I will never work for this person's welfare, based upon some conditions such as unacceptable actions, etc. Now, for example, sometimes when talk about the enemy who is enemy in terms of 10 features, so sometimes we perform certain wrathful practices also. So here, when you do such wrathful practices in destroying the so-called enemy, it is important that it should be influenced with compassion, concern, and so forth. Otherwise, you might develop genuine ill will and abandon that living being, and in this way lose your bodhicitta. So even in the case of an evil force, an evil sentient being who must be tamed or disciplined or destroyed through certain wrathful practices, it should be done with concern, with compassion, with the understanding of selflessness. Now, for example, in the case of those many Chinese who see the Buddha, Buddha and the Buddha's teaching as a poison and so forth, even in relation to this. You should develop genuine compassion, and so irrespective of whoever the sentient being is, you should never mentally abandon them. Now again, this does not mean that you should be a stupid man who would give a free hand to all those wrongdoers. You take tough measures, and thinking that if I allow this person or this group of sentient beings engage in such a negative way of life, they themselves will end up experiencing sufferings, difficulties and problems. So with this kind of concern, you adopt forceful, wrathful practices to control them, to tame them. And when you see in this way, then again you will be amazed how skillful such bodhisattva practices are, because you adopt such wrathful practices with the motivation to help and tame those unruly sentient beings, and with a wish to help them in the long run. Temporarily you adopt tough measures, wrathful practices to control them. But even under such practices, you should not mentally abandon them, because from today onward, since you have now cultivated this bodhicitta for the sake of all sentient beings include everybody, you can't leave one or two individuals out. So mentally do not abandon them. You abandon living beings when you think, now I will never work for this person's well-being. Next is the training in the precept to accumulate the collections of merit and sublime wisdom. After you have adopted the aspirational spirit of enlightenment through its ritual, strive daily to accumulate the collections, making offerings to the three jewels, etc., in order to increase the spirit of enlightenment. Although I have seen no authoritative source for this being a precept other than former teachers' statements, it is nevertheless very beneficial. Next is the training in the precept that causes you to not separate from your spirit of enlightenment in future lifetime as well. So having cultivated bodhicitta, number one, remember their qualities, benefits again and again. Number two, meditate on and meditate and recite these vows of cultivating bodhicitta and taking refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And then not to mentally abandon the living beings, then to accumulate the collections of merit and sublime wisdom. So next is the training in the precept that causes you to not separate from your spirit of enlightenment in future lifetimes as well, which is explained under two sections. First is the training in the precept to eliminate the four dark practices which weaken the spirit of enlightenment. In the Kashyapa chapter of the Ratnakuta collection, there are statements that list the four practices with respect to not actualizing or forgetting the spirit of enlightenment in future lifetimes, and that list the four practices with respect to actualizing and not forgetting the spirit of enlightenment, not casting it aside until you reach enlightenment. They are presented as precepts of the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. The four dark practices are as follows. 1. Deceiving abodes, masters, gurus and those worthy of offerings. Understand this in terms of two approaches: the objects of your action and what you do to these objects. According to the explanation in Sthirimati's commentary on the Kashyapa chapter, the objects are abodes and masters and those worthy of offerings. What might you do to these objects that would be a dark practice? It's a dark practice if you consciously deceive any of them. With respect to how you deceive them, the commentary on the Kashyapa chapter says that when you compassionately explain transgressions and you then confuse them about yourself with lies, it is dark. It says that whenever you try to mislead your gurus about yourself with an intention to deceive, it is dark. However, it has to be misleading with lies. The deception which is not lying will be dealt with below. This is because its remedy is the first of the four light practices, and the compendium of training says that eliminating the dark practices is a light practice. Moreover, it is said that incorrigible students deceive their gurus when they say one thing to the guru and secretly say something very different to others, who then say, "Careful, this will come to the teacher's ears." Second, making others feel regret about something that is not regrettable. This is understood through the same two approaches mentioned previously. The object is persons cultivating virtue without regret. What do you do to them? You intentionally make them regret something they should not regret. The commentary on the Kashyapa chapter explains that deceitfully misleading fellow practitioners with respect to a training's wording when they are observing the trainings correctly is dark. For these first two dark practices, it is said to make no difference whether or not you are able to deceive or whether or not you are able to cause regret. So the second dark practice is letting your spiritual friends to develop regret in relation to their virtuous practice, which is actually not an object to be regretted. Third is speaking disparagingly, etc., to beings who have correctly entered the Mahayana. Some say that the object is those who have the spirit of enlightenment, having adopted it through its ritual. Others say it is equally those who have previously developed the spirit of enlightenment and do not currently have it. This latter assertion contradicts the sutras and is wrong. The commentary says simply a bodhisattva with no further clarification. Even though in other scriptural contexts there are many statements that those with the bodhisattva vows who are learning the trainings are the ones who have correctly entered the Mahayana, I think that here the object has to be understood as any bodhisattva, starting with those who have generated the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. What is done to this bodhisattva is to speak disparagingly with blame, with a label and so forth. The assertion that what is said has to be motivated by hatred accords with the commentary, but even though the commentary says that the bodhisattvas to whom it is spoken are diligently seeking the teachings and the words are spoken in order to stop their belief in or wish to practice the Mahayana, it seems to be enough if they understand the meaning of what is said. The commentary explains that something disparaging is, for example, saying that he or she has poor character, wherein you do not mention any specific fault. And blame is, for example, saying he is not celibate, wherein you are specific, and libel is, for example, saying in this or that way he engaged in sex, making it more specific. The commentary attaches the term criticism to these three. I have already discussed briefly the danger of this great offense arising in us. Indeed, if bodhisattvas have even a despising thought toward other bodhisattvas, they have to stay in hell for as many eons as the moments of that thought's duration. And the sutra on the magic of final peace says that no other action apart from slandering another bodhisattva can make a bodhisattva fall into the miserable realms. This is also said in the word summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. Thus it says that they must travel along the path, starting over again, for eons commensurate with their angry attitude. They become very far distant from their enlightenment. For this reason, stop your anger on all occasions, and if it arises, immediately confess it and strive to restrain yourself, as the same text states. If you give hatred a chance, the love and compassion you have developed will weaken, and it will be hard to develop any new love and compassion, even if you practice for a long time. Thus you cut the root of the spirit enlightenment. If you stop hatred, the unfavorable conditions for love and compassion, and cultivate love and compassion according to the previous explanation, they then progressively increase and eventually become limitless, as Dharmakirti says in his compendium of valid cognition. For In the fourth dark practice is, in an absence of sincerity, using deceit and misinterpretation to get the service of others. The object is any living beings other than yourself. What is done to this being? You act with deceit and misrepresentation. Sincerity is explained in the commentary on the Kashyapa chapter to be your ordinary attitude. Deceit and misrepresentation are cheating while measuring with a scale and so forth. As Jalvin Jungne says, it is, for instance, like sending somebody to Tolong, a place, in order to get them to go to Ragma, a place far past Tolong, and later asserting that they might as well go on to Ragma. Asanga's compendium of knowledge says that both deceit and misrepresentation arise because of attachment to goods and services, and are similarly included in the category of either attachment or ignorance. He says that deceit is to pretend that you have a good quality that you do not have, and misrepresentation is hiding your fault. Hiding means using some method to conceal a fault. The training in the precept to adopt the four light or for white practices, or for virtuous practices which keep the spirit of enlightenment from weakening. 1. Forsaking consciously lying to any living being, whatever, even in jest or even for the sake of your life. So there is no total lie. And in the case of, however, in the case of those of you who go back to Tibet, the situation is such that you will be compelled to tell some lies. I think this is probably acceptable because of the uncontrollable situation. So otherwise, so I would say that giving exception to some situations, since you have cultivated bodhicitta, do not tell lie. But there are such difficult situations. It's not only in relation to Chinese. There are people who keep on bullying you, exploiting you, torturing you, oppressing you. Under such situations, you are compelled to tell some lies with specific important purpose. And so in general, it's really important to be very honest and upright, because if you tell lie, then it proves that you are a person who cannot be trusted. So the object of the first of the four light practices, any living beings, what you do is force consciously lying even for the sake of your life or even in jest. In this way you do not deceive special objects of your actions, your abode master, etc. with lies. Second is not deceiving but remaining sincere to all living beings. The object of the second of the four light practices is all living beings. What you do is not deceive them but maintain your sincerity. That is, remain honest. This is the remedy for the fourth dark practices. 3. Developing the idea that all bodhisattvas are the teacher. The object of the third virtuous practice is all bodhisattvas. What you do is develop the idea that they are similar to the teacher and voice in the four directions praise of their character. We cultivate some small likeness of virtue but find that it has no signs of increasing and has many signs of decreasing. This is simply the outcome of our hating, despising or reviling bodhisattvas and friends. Therefore it is said that if you are capable of eliminating the first four faults, two faults as well as the reviling of bodhisattvas, all the harm related to persons mentioned in the compendium of trainings will be averted. This is based on the consideration that you do not know who is a bodhisattva. So as stated in the Kashyapa chapter, so as is said here, that you praise other qualities only if others are appreciating and listening to this. It is not like praising the Chinese propaganda, because they keep on advertising their propaganda irrespective of whether others are listening or not. You should train in the pure perception of all living beings that comes from developing the idea that all beings are the teacher. You should praise bodhisattvas when there are listeners on hand. But you incur no fault if you do not go out into the four directions praising them, like the Chinese propaganda, His Holiness was saying. This is the remedy for the third dark practice. 4. Causing the living beings that you are helping to mature to not want the modest vehicle but to adhere to perfect enlightenment. The object of the fourth light practice is the living beings that you are helping to mature. What you do to them is cause them to not want the modest vehicle but to adhere to perfect enlightenment. Moreover, from your perspective, it is necessary for them to connect to the Mahayana path, but if your disciples do not develop the intention for it, you incur no fault, because you are simply unable to accomplish it. This light practice eliminates the second dark practice. Because if you want from the depths of your heart for others to set forth toward the culmination of all happiness, you will not do something that brings about unhappiness in others so as to make them feel some regret about their virtuous activity, as he said in the sutra requested by a line. Furthermore, the area of qualities in Manjushri's Buddha realm says that if you have these four, destruction of pride, elimination of jealousy, elimination of stinginess, and joy when you see the prosperity of others, you do not relinquish your aspirational prayer. Once you cultivate the spirit of enlightenment, you will not be separated from the precious attitude even in future lives. This is stated clearly in the Cloud of Jewel Sutra and the King of Concentration Sutras, and in other sutras as well. Next is the method of repairing the spirit of enlightenment if you do weaken it. Many scholars state the following view. You relinquish the aspirational spirit of enlightenment if a certain period passes and there are four dark practices together with the fifth, mentally abandoning living beings, or a sixth, casting aside the spirit of enlightenment by thinking, I cannot accomplish Buddhahood. However, if within a period of time you regret these six, they weaken the aspirational spirit of enlightenment but do not cause you to abandon it. And if you fail to adopt the spirit of enlightenment six times each day and allow your training in the two collections to degenerate, it only weakens the spirit of enlightenment. If a course of relinquishing it occurs, you must repeat the ritual for adopting the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. But for a mere weakening, you do not have to repeat it. Making a confession suffices. With respect to this, if you should think, I cannot accomplish Buddhahood, you immediately abandon the spirit of enlightenment. It is never necessary to rely on the passage of a certain period of time, such as an assertion is absolutely incorrect. The four dark practices are not the cause of relinquishing the spirit of enlightenment in this life, but are causes for not manifesting the spirit of enlightenment in the future lives. So we should stop them in this life, as is said in Adisha's lamp for the path to enlightenment. That have been explained means, as explained in the Kashyap chapter, this is what the sutra means, because it clearly says this in the context of the four light practices. So although it is not stated clearly in the context of the four dark practices whether they affect this life or future lives, understand that it is the latter. Otherwise, if bodhisattvas who are keeping their vows just lie a bit as a joke, deceive others and misrepresent themselves to them in a trifling way, say something slightly bad about bodhisattvas out of anger, or just engender slight regret in others with respect to their cultivation of virtuous root, and if they pass a period of time without feeling regret, then they would lose their bodhisattva vows. They would lose them because they would have lost the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. And according to both the bodhisattva levels and the competitive of trainings, when you lose the aspirational spirit, you lose the vows as well. If you make the assertion that they do lose their vows, then you have to posit these dark practices as fundamental transgressions. And this is not said anywhere and is incorrect. Furthermore, recurring a period of time is based upon the period explained in the questions of Upali Sutra. But since I have proven at length in my basic path to awakening and explanation of the chapter on ethical discipline of the bodhisattva levels, that this is not the meaning of the sutra, I will not explain it again here. To mentally abandon living beings means that when considering them in general, you think, I am not able to work for the welfare of these many beings. When you abandon them with this thought, it is clear that you abandon the aspirational spirit of enlightenment. And when considering a particular living being, if you have the thought, I will never work for the welfare of this one, then like destroying a whole collection by destroying just a piece of it, you destroy the spirit of enlightenment which is developed for the sake of all living beings. Were it otherwise, you could cast aside many beings, a second, third, fourth, and so forth, develop the spirit of enlightenment for the sake of the remaining beings, and would necessarily have thereby generated a completely perfect spirit of enlightenment, but this is not the case. The commentary on the difficult points of the lamp for the path to enlightenment says, of these precepts of the spirit of enlightenment, that there are the different systems of King Indrabhuti, Nagarjuna, Asanga, Ayasura, Shantideva, Chandragomin, Shantarakshita, etc. It says that some assert that the precepts of the spirit of enlightenment are all the precepts for both the initial generation of the spirit of enlightenment and for engaging in the bodhisattva deeds. Others, it says, assert that you have to observe every precept stated in the sutras, while still others say that they are all precepts for a person on the path to enlightenment accumulation. Some do not assert that there are a specific training like this or that, and yet others state that in addition to the precepts of refuge, you observe the 8 practices of not abandoning the intention to take up the 4 light practices and forgetting the intention that leads to the 4 dark practices. The commentary explains, my guru said that since the systems of these masters is based on sutra, you should uphold whatever systems your guru gives you. It claims that all of these are the meaning of the sutras. In general, the great teachers of the lineage descended from Geshen Rungtomba do not recognize the commentary on the difficult points of the Lamb of the Path to Enlightenment to be a commentary by the great elder. But the lineages from Naksu accepted this as the great elder's composition and also accepted it as a teaching hidden by Naksu. Still, it was well known to earlier scholars that Atisha composed a short commentary while in Purang. It is said that when he thereafter arrived in Samyi, a translator asked him if he could add to it, and the translator subsequently expanded it. Therefore, the great elder did compose a short commentary. This is supplemented by a number of explanations which are based on various guru sayings. There are some obvious mistakes, and there are also many good explanations of the meanings of the scriptures. So I have cited in the stages of the path and elsewhere in explanation of the points on which it is not mistaken. Next is an introduction to the 6 perfections, page 85. How to learn the Bodhisattva deeds after developing the spirit of enlightenment, which has 3 parts. The first is the reason why you must learn the trainings after developing the spirit of enlightenment. It is indeed the case that great benefit comes from mere development of the spiritual spirit of enlightenment without learning the trainings of generosity and so forth. Consider in this regard the passage from the life of Maitreya cited earlier. However, you still have to practice the Bodhisattva trainings. If you do not emphasize this practice, you will never become a Buddha. So learn the Bodhisattva deeds, as is said in the foremost of Gaya, the King of Concentration Sutra, the stages of meditation, Dharmakirti's compendium of valid cognition. Those who have great compassion for others feel the need to relieve other sufferings. To relieve it, the kind thought may they be free of their suffering is not enough. They must engage in the method that will bring it about. Now, if they do not first engage in this method themselves, they will be unable to free others. Therefore, if you want to work for others' welfare, you must first discipline yourself. In reference to this, the Kings of Concentration Sutra says that you should take practice to heart. Practice is said to be learning the training in the precepts associated with the Bodhisattva vows. After you have taken them, therefore it is very important that you are not mistaken about just what is entailed in taking practice to heart. So we stop the morning session here.